Clayton, and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. For much of this year, Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act has been a totemic issue for conservative forces within the coalition. Calls for that part of the Act to be changed have reached a crescendo following the dismissal by the Federal Court of a prominent court case involving students and a staff member from the Queensland University of Technology. The Human Rights Commission is also investigating a cartoon drawn by the Australian's Bill Leak. And now the government is going to launch a parliamentary inquiry into 18C. Today we're joined by Liberal backbencher Julian Leeser, who is running against the tide of his party by backing 18C as it stands, but favouring administrative changes. Julian Leeser, last week you made a strong defence of Section 18C. Many of your coalition colleagues have been very vocal in their criticisms, but is there a quiet majority or even a substantial minority within your Liberal Party who would like to maintain the law as it stands?
Thanks, Michelle. There are definitely people within the party who share my view that Section 18C achieves a good balance between allowing people the freedom of speech, which is necessary in a democracy like Australia, but also protecting racial minorities from racial vilification and racial slurs. And as I said in my speech to the Chinese community, part of the new enlightenment, as it were, that came out of the Second World War was an understanding that the racial politics, the racial categorisation of people of the past was wrong, and out of that developed these anti-racial vilification laws, of which Section 18C is the most modern example, or one of the most modern examples. But the thing that I think unites everybody in this debate, regardless of your view on Section 18C, is that the process underscored in the QUT case and also in the Bill Leak case, it just didn't work as well as it should have. These cases seem to take a very long time, and there are not enough incentives for the Human Rights Commission to dismiss cases that have no reasonable prospect of success. And that's what the reforms I've proposed really try to address.
So how would they actually work?
I think the first thing I might do is explain a little bit about how the Commission deals with cases when they come in. So the Commission's powers under the Human Rights Commission Act are to investigate and conciliate. They must do those with all cases, with all written complaints that come in about 18C. The Commission President is in charge of these matters, and she may, and the word is may, not must, terminate matters if they're vexatious. For instance, there are a whole range of different grounds. But one of those grounds is not little prospect or no reasonable prospect of success. What I'm suggesting happen is that instead of the primary function being investigate, conciliate, that the primary function start being investigate and determine whether the case has a reasonable prospect of success, and if it doesn't, terminate as quickly as possible. I've also proposed that an applicant who's made a complaint, the complainant, if they don't like that decision of the Human Rights Commission, they could then take the matter to court, but the grounds of appeal from the Human Rights Commission's termination be limited to jurisdictional error. So not the errors of fact, but really the errors of law, and that an applicant would need to put up security for costs. So this would deter spurious cases being pursued further, and it would also mean that cases before the Commission would be determined quickly. The final point that I've made is that I actually think to bolster the Commission's ability to do this, that a part-time judicial member of the Commission be appointed, in other words, a federal court judge, to actually deal with these Part 2A cases.
Now, the way the issue seems to be going at the moment is that the government's likely, in fact, to look at those sort of procedural changes or some procedural changes, but also it wants this inquiry, parliamentary inquiry, into 18C, which would look at removing insult and offend. What do you think about the parliamentary inquiry?
Well, look, I've made my position on Section 18C clear, but one of the things that I think my own proposal would benefit from is some further discussion and debate. Since I've put it up, I've had colleagues come and make some further suggestions to me about things that you could do. One of my colleagues suggested, for instance, you could put a time limit on the amount of time it takes the Commission to actually determine these matters and to either conciliate or terminate, as the case may be. And I think that's a helpful contribution. One of the things that's good about the political process is that you're supposed to be able to throw something up and get people to react to it and give you their ideas. And every policy idea benefits from debate about a genuine debate, not, you know, let's just shut that idea down or let's praise that idea, but actually thinking about, well, how would this work and how could you improve it further? And so I think my own proposal would benefit from some further discussion.
Before Tony Abbott aborted the last attempt to change 18C, there was a huge backlash from the ethnic community, from the Jewish community. Do you think that the government's in for a fresh backlash?
Look, I know a number of the various multicultural communities in Australia feel very, very strongly about this. Chinese, Indian, Jewish, Arab, you know, Indigenous communities all feel very strongly about
this. They haven't changed their mind.
I don't see that they've changed their mind. One of the things that's come out of Friday's QUT case is that a lot of people think, well, that's actually a vindication that the section works as designed. It's really, Section 18C is really there as an in case of fire break glass provision. It's there for the most serious and substantial cases. And I think possibly other than the complainant in that case, there's no one in Australia who really thought that the complainant in the QUT case has a real chance of success. And similarly with the Bill Leak case, I don't think that there are many people that think that has any real chance of success either. I think one of the things that the government is obviously looking to do is looking for a way forward in these areas, and that's why I've put forward my proposal to try and improve the process. And I should say, whether it's the IPA or whether it's Nick Xenophon or whether it's Bob Carr or whether it's the President of the Human Rights Commission herself, everybody acknowledges that the process needs to be improved here.
I heard one of your New South Wales backbench colleagues, John Alexander, saying this morning that really this is pretty low on ordinary people's priorities as an issue. Would you agree from the feedback from your electorate?
Yes, I think John Alexander's right. This is not, I mean, people are wanting us to deal with the economy, work out where they're going to get jobs from, dealing with housing affordability, those sorts of issues. But in my own electorate, wherever I've gone and said that I support Section 18C as it currently stands, which I did during the election campaign, which has been government policy under the Turnbull government and under the second half of the Abbott government too, I always got a cheer, almost always got a cheer from people. I think there's actually, in the broader community, there's support for racial vilification laws.
Let's talk about another issue that's fairly hot this week, that is same-sex marriage. Now, the Senate has killed off the plebiscite. Is that it for this term of government?
Speaking for myself, I think, yes, that is. I mean, the government has taken the plebiscite to the election. It was well ventilated in the party room before the election, a party room I wasn't part of, but it was well ventilated at that time. It was very much the policy of the election. In my own electorate, it was one of the key issues I got asked about regularly at train stations and public meetings. What was my view on same-sex marriage? What's my view on the plebiscite? I'm a supporter of traditional marriage, but I think the plebiscite is a good way of dealing with it. We put this forward. The Labor Party has chosen to reject it as of the crossbenchers in the Senate. I think the plebiscite will remain our policy going forward.
Even until the next term?
I don't see any change in the plebiscite policy.
And what do you think the reaction of the community will be? Labor is obviously anxious, and sections of the gay community, well, the whole gay community, I guess, they're anxious to keep it to the forefront of political debate. Do you think that will happen?
Well, I think people have had a real prospect for a resolution of this issue through the plebiscite. And I actually spoke on the plebiscite bill in the House of Representatives. One of the things that I pointed out there was, having been a member of the government No Committee for the 1999 referendum, that some of the issues that people were worried about vilification of gay people, I think are misplaced, because there are processes that were involved in the development of advertisements in the 1999 referendum.
Republic referendum,
that's right, which were mirrored in the legislation around needing to put the advertisements before the government committees. There's oversight by the Electoral Commission, by Free TV Australia, by ultimately the Federal Court and so on. And I remember being on the No Committee for the Republic referendum. We would bowl up ads from time to time and they would get knocked back by the government committee because they didn't meet the advertising guidelines. It's not a free speech free-for-all, as it were. And so I think some of the fears are a little misplaced in that space. And I think we could have a sensible and respectful conversation about this issue. When I was in a previous life at Australian Catholic University, I ran a series of respectful conversations between advocates for change, people like Christina Keneally and Tim Wilson, and people who were in favour of traditional marriage like Miranda Devine and Bishop Peter Comensoli. And they demonstrated that you could actually have a reasonable discussion about some of the issues in this space. And I still believe that we can do that.
Now, you're from the New South Wales Liberal Party and there's a sometimes not respectful discussion going on there about party reform. How do you see this issue playing out in the next few months? It's coming back to the party next year. There's a big push for making the party more democratic, for plebiscites for choosing candidates. Where's it going to end and where do you stand on this?
So I think, just to take a step backwards, one of the key problems that all political parties face, but I think we face it more in the Liberal Party than others, is that the party membership now has been dwindling for 20 years and it's almost reached a crisis point around the country. And whereas our principal political opponents, the Labor Party, has the support of the trade unions and GetUp, we just have our party members. They're all that that stands between us and electoral oblivion, as it were. And you need a large volunteer army, not just to help you on election day, not just to help you with the pre-poll and the door knocking, but to help you across the whole period. I'm in a unique part of the Liberal Party in Sydney and Barara, in that our party still, I think, reflects the party of the Menzies years. We've got a conference of about 900 people, about three quarters of whom played an active role in the election campaign, either assisting me or assisting other candidates in New South Wales. We have active branches. My branch, the Fox Valley branch, is the largest branch in the state, over 200 members. We found our members by going door to door and having community barbecues, inviting people to come and meet their local members and to get involved in discussion.
The attraction of a sausage.
The attraction of a sausage. You know, the political sausage sizzle is one of the attractions of going to voting day. Why shouldn't it be an attraction at other times as well? And what we've really built in our branch is a strong sense of community among our membership. One of the things I've read a lot about President Obama's first campaign and a lot about volunteer organisations, be it Rotary or Lions or sporting clubs. And what builds those organisations, and a political party is no different, is the human interaction with people who are like other people and the chance to make a contribution to the country in a political organisation by getting your candidates elected or preventing the other side getting elected or having a say on policy and the direction of the country. I think there are a range of things that we need to do in our party to try and bolster that style of engagement. And the party reform proposal that was put forward by the Prime Minister and the Premier, and which I spoke in favour of during the party conference a couple of weeks ago, basically sets out a process where it will end in what's called a party futures convention, which is designed to really address some of these big issues. Yes, the selection of candidates is a question, but it's only one of the questions that we need to look at. We need to look at the issue of how do we attract more women? How do we attract a diverser group of candidates in terms of multicultural communities? How do we ensure that members are actually getting more value for their money? So I'm looking forward to participating in that process and participating in those conversations.
Do you think, though, those who have power in the party will really fight meaningful reform because they want to hang on to that power?
Look, I think there is an overstatement of some of the people who are supposed to have power in the party. I think that benefits them and it benefits the people who don't like them as well. I think there are aspects of the party that do need to be changed. I remain to be convinced about the plebiscite system, to be honest. That's a position that's well known. And in my conference, we voted 130 to 13 against plebiscite. So it's
What's
not a view
your doubt
generally.
About the plebiscite system?
Well, the real doubt is, unfortunately, in New South Wales, and it's not confined to our party, there's a lamentable history of branch stacking, particularly of an ethnic or religious nature. And all parts of the party have done this for their own ends at different times. And that's been really slowed down in the last 8 years since some reforms were made in 2008, which allowed people to bring in a maximum of 10 members a month to a branch. If you have a system where every member of the party in a conference votes, if you set up a system, people will game the system. What worries me is that the only way you will be able to game the system is by that sort of ethnic or religious branch stacking, and I think that's a great shame for our party. We do need to grow the membership. We do need to give the members more of a say. And reforms that were passed at the end of last year, which had the backing of both the then party president, Trent Zimmerman, and also Walter Villatoura, the leading campaigner for this change to plebiscites, those reforms doubled the number of local people engaged in selections. Those reforms come in next year. They take effect from next year. And in many conferences, that will mean almost everybody who's in the conference gets to be a selector. But, you know, political parties are an unfinished canvas and we need constantly to be looking at what we can do. One of the things I am very strong on that we need to do is to look at what's happening in Britain, a system that the Conservative Party has had for a long time, which we've never adopted, which is the Parliamentary Assessment Board system, where if you'd like to be a parliamentary candidate, you go before an assessment board, they look and see, you know, are you articulate, can you write, are you aware of current affairs, can you debate, and they give you a tick or a cross. It's a professional assessment system, and then you get put on a list. Once you're on a list of possible parliamentary candidates, you need to work in the party, you need to raise money, you need to build the organisation, you need to contribute to the intellectual side of the party. And if a local constituency association, as they call them in Britain, is interested in finding a candidate, they can choose anyone from the approved list. That ensures that we don't have situations, as we've had in the past, sadly, where we've had candidates that were just unsuitable chosen, who really weren't up to either performing the task of being a parliamentarian or even actually being a candidate, even in a dead red seat. So I think there are the advantage of this process that the Prime Minister and the Premier have set up is it's an opportunity to borrow from Mao, let a thousand flowers bloom and let people submit ideas for the future of the party.
You came in at the last election, so you're still obviously getting your feet under the desk in the parliamentary process, but you made, I think, a huge impact with your maiden speech, which was a very moving speech, a quite spine-chilling speech, really, about your father's suicide. How difficult was it to make that speech? Why was it important to you? And what sort of reaction have you got?
My father took his own life 20 years ago, and at that time I was a local councillor, and I remember saying to my mum at the time, look, I think there's an opportunity I have in the public position which I occupy to try and do something so more people recognise the signs that a person is contemplating taking their own life. And I told the story at my maiden speech of the fact that the week before my father died, we were always a family that hugged each other, but he started to give us these unusual, very long hugs. He was always very proud of his precision car parking, and then the week before he didn't seem to care. You know, it was clear something was wrong, but we just didn't say anything. And I wanted to say something and do something to prevent that happening to other families. And I talked to Mum about it at the time, and neither she nor my younger brother were really emotionally prepared to go out and be quite so public on those things. And when I had, after the election, I was thinking about what I'd say in the maiden speech, and I wanted to return to this issue. And so I talked to my mum and my brother, and I did the first draft of the speech, recalling the night that my father died. And that's a memory that is so seared on my mind. I don't think I'll ever forget it. I don't think I'll ever forget the sound or the visuals of that night. And I sat them both down separately and I read the speech. They had tears in their eyes. My mother very happily remarried 10 years ago, and her husband Alan also teared up too. And my mum said to me, look, I think enough time has passed now. I think you could do some real good by talking about this. I wanted to put this on the public record because I don't want anybody else to miss the signs that somebody's giving them. I also wanted people who are bereaved by suicide or who might be contemplating taking their own lives to know that there are people in this place who understand what they're going through and who want to do something to try and make better mental health policy for the country. The reaction to the speech has been far beyond anything I would have imagined. I expected that we would have calls to the office of people who were bereaved by suicide or people who were contemplating taking their own lives. And the week before, I asked Lifeline to come in and brief my staff so we knew what to do if people called up. But, you know, I still get about 3 letters or emails a day reacting to the maiden speech, even now almost 2 months since the speech. I've heard stories from colleagues in this building, from people on, from people who've left politics on the other side. I was honoured to receive letters from Jeff Gallop and Julia Gillard, who neither of Jeff I know a little, but Julia Gillard I've never met, and I'd said some strong things about her on television when she was Prime Minister, and it was a great honour to get a letter from her complimenting me on the speech, as I have had from our former Prime Ministers here too. But it's an issue that just touches so many Australians, and what I've seen talking both to experts in the area and people who've come to tell me their own stories is that there are still a few key gaps in the area. And the government's got a very good $192 million national suicide prevention strategy that involves some of the public health networks in local areas and trying to look for what's working and to scale it up. But there's a couple of areas I think we're not doing as well as we could. One of those areas is the post-mental health hospital admission discharge. I think it varies state to state. I was on a hospital board in Victoria, and I think the system of stepping down from hospital to home is much better than we have, say, in New South Wales. There are, in a very Victorian England sense, there are lots of people who have decided to make a contribution because it's such an enormous life event if they've gone through it or been bereaved by it, by setting up organisations. And a number of those organisations would like to get into schools, particularly the ones that are focused on youth mental health. And I think we don't necessarily have a good path for assessing their suitability and then providing an opportunity to get into schools. What I intend to do in this space is over the course of the next year to continue to talking to experts, to talk to people who have lived experiences and perhaps write a book about my journey in this space, outlining some of those experiences, outlining some of the gaps, and perhaps proposing some additional ways forward.
Well, certainly you've made, I think, a very important contribution with that very, very personal account. Julie and Lisa, thank you very much for talking with the conversation today. That's all for our podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. I'm Michelle Grattan. We'll be back again soon.